This is the Oil and Gas Startups Podcast, where we showcase emerging technology and the stories of industry founders, investors, and leaders with your hosts, Jake Corley and Colin McClelland.
What's going on, Walkouters? Welcome back to another episode of the Oil and Gas Startups Podcast. We have none other than Peter Snell with PetroVibe here in the studio down from Dallas. What's up, man?
Nothing, man. Glad to be here. I love it. I took the Vaughn Lane bus to get here.
And how is that?
It's normally awesome.
Yeah.
Today it was a challenge. The first time I've ridden that bus probably half a dozen times in the last few months, and probably 20 sometimes in the last 5 years. And this is the first time they've ever been late. They always leave right on the button. And today we were an hour and 15 minutes late.
But that's still like, a great trip. The executive charters, right?
Yeah.
Almost. So, like you get like the nice like recliner seats and stuff.
Yeah, it's not the dog.
Okay.
Or the Greyhound.
As yeah.
People would. Yeah, it's like cushy. Your timeline is similar to flying, except for you don't have to go through all the security hassle. It's
yeah.
Way better. And you get great service. I highly recommend it for whatever that's worth.
I've never done it before.
You should.
Have you ever done JSX?
I have actually.
I love JSX. So, they just put Starlink on all their
planes. Did they really?
So you can sit there and FaceTime on a.
No way.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it's the
best. Starlink gives you the next level of
internet.
I did not know.
Yeah.
I have done JSX. It's like that.
Yeah.
Only it's on the ground. And when you're going to Houston, why not? I mean, it's three hours, 45 minutes. Great. I highly recommend it. But JSX, awesome.
I'll have to check it out.
You should.
PetroVibe, what are you guys doing over there?
PetroVibe. So, well, we're drilling wells, or we're starting to anyway. But PetroVibe is, it's an oil and gas development company. But I like to think of it as fuel for the grid. You know, everybody's all hopped up on electric today. And so when I think about it, I think about the things we're doing. You know, Teslas don't run themselves. They're storage, not source. We're in the business of source.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a project in South Texas and a great team, and it's pretty awesome. We just got started a few months ago and already been raising capital, and we're excited about this particular project. It's got several million dollars already sunk in the science, so it's good.
Are you guys going to operate these wells?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. We're an operator. Yeah. So we got a license and everything. So we got our first permit.
Happened
yesterday. So we're pretty excited about that. Permitting may not be that exciting for some folks, but for us, we were, at least as a group. I mean, my team's got oodles of experience. My geologist is 74 years old. When he probably could, he used to run marathons and he's still fit. So he's amazing, has an unbelievable track record and is just super smart. He's also a visionary, which makes for an interesting combination. But my other team, I've got a petroleum engineer who literally, when he started his career, he was a roughneck. And he told me a story. I was like, dude, tell me your craziest story. So he told me this story about one time when he was working in an ocean platform. He was trying to get hooked into the ladder up the platform. And fortunately, he got hooked on. But when he stepped off of the boat to get onto the ladder, he slipped and plummeted into the ocean. And it was really rough seas. So the fact that he didn't get crushed was a miracle. But he chuckles. He's 34 years old. So I don't know if he's still like missing a few screws or something at that age. But that's our FP&A guy. So he does all of our.
There's nothing more terrifying than the ocean, in my opinion.
I mean,
especially being that far out.
Well, and on a when it's rough, and I mean, it's not like, yeah, I don't know. He's kind of a mad scientist, but anyway, he's a petroleum engineer by training and by education. But he went to work for a PE firm and learned how to do FP&A, and he's awesome. Like it's his superpower. So anyway, he's pretty excited about what's going on at PetroVibe, but I love that guy. So, and then our Blaine, our COO, he's amazing. He's drilled somewhere around north of 400 wells himself, but he's supervised north of 10,000 wells. He's kind of done it all. He's roughly my age, 30 years in the industry, and just done a lot of stuff, but he's really good at scale, which is, and I think what's better for us as a team, since I get to talk about them, I love these guys. I mean, they're just salt of the earth. But what's really cool about us is all the fit. We were just talking about it. We just had lunch. And the four of us are so different. And I can't forget about Ryan, my partner up in Dallas, who's loves the oil business. But if you look at all four of us, we all have like unique skill sets, but we like each other as people and we're very different. And we just get along, and we get along better the further we go. And if anybody knows anything about the oil business, which obviously you do, and so do a lot of people probably listening, but it can stress relationships. So we've already had a lot of stress.
And business in general can stress relationships. Well, and then the oil field makes it even tougher.
Exactly. Well, and then layer into that fundraising. So it's been complex, but I don't know. Love the guys. They seem to love each other, and it's going good. It's going good.
So we got a lot to talk about. So what's your background?
So probably the simplest way to look at it is I'm a business fixer. You know, I've been in some form of, in the old days, sales and marketing at some level, that kind of evolved into a brand expert, and then it morphed into management consulting. And so that's actually how I got involved in the oil business, was as a business fixer. And so I like solving problems. The bigger and hairier, probably the more interesting to me. I have a high tolerance for risk, which is maybe why I like the oil business. My wife, however, does not have that same high tolerance for risk, but she's been learning since we've been married almost 26 years. So she's an incredible woman. I would have given up on me a few more times if I were in her shoes, but she's an incredible person. But yeah, the story is I like fixing problems or creating things. And you have to create a lot when you're fixing, but the difference is when you're fixing, you're always under duress. Now, as I've been creating just for the, you know, from a clean slate, there's a different kind of duress. So you're always under duress. That's really the story. But the duress when you're fixing is you're forced to make decisions much more quickly with imperfect information, far less perfect information. I will say the more I go through this creation stage of PetraVibe, the more I find similarity to fixing, because a lot of the conditions are fairly similar. So why
out of all the problems to solve, why be an operator? Like, I mean, that's just waking up asking to get kicked in the nuts every day.
Yeah, that's probably fair. Maybe part of it is, you know, I don't have 30 years of operating experience. That's what those other guys I just talked about are for. So, I think the key for me is I've spent a career advising people, helping them solve their problems as a function of solving the problem. And, it was kind of a amalgamation of things. I liked the idea of being able to create something tangible. I believe that's how God made me. I'm designed for tangibility, and yet I picked a career path that largely was void of that, or I was helping others do their tangible things. And so I think that was one of the things. Like I said, I love risk, and I say I love risk. I like the challenge of it. I don't like failing any more than anybody else, but I'm pretty resilient, and I don't take that as a... It's not one of those things where I say, okay, I'm resilient, so I just accept that. I think I just, observing myself objectively, I am resilient. It's not something I take pride in because I don't know how to. It's more of just, again, how God made me. So I like the tangibility of it, and there's nothing more American. And man, we need some patriotism around here. I mean, the country needs to be able to rally around some things that are good for everybody. And I know there's, you know, people out there who think this isn't good. That's certainly, they're entitled to their opinion. But for me, those were really the reasons. And if I dug in a little bit deeper, I would say I love the people. Not all the people. There's bad apples in every bunch, right? But this industry is full of a lot of really just simple, I guess that's not the right word, simple to like. Straightforward, I'd say good folks. At least that's been my experience. Again, I've met some that I'd like to leave behind, but you're going to do that no matter what you do. So I also, and this is kind of a little bit of a sidetrack here, but one of the things that I really like about this industry is I'm kind of a student of history. And so you think about, you know, let's zoom out for a second. You think about business in general, right? There's some really interesting success stories and cautionary tales. So, and a lot of this comes from just, you know, being curious and interested in other things. But think about like IBM, great success story when you look at such a long period of history, because IBM has reinvented itself multiple times. And certainly they've had their struggles, but it's funny, when I used to do workshops, I would talk about IBM and how they were, I would just ask, is anybody in the room? Because I'm dealing with a bunch of millennials in some of those cases, but I would ask, do you know what IBM stands for? And they would often, most of the time, not know, because if you're not 50 or 40 something plus, you just don't know. You're kind of familiar with IBM as a brand, but you don't really know what it stands for because they haven't been using their actual, you know, it's International Business Machines. Well, they're not selling hardware for forever. I mean, they're a software consulting and AI company and have been for some time. You know, Watson, that was their big brand for the last 15 years. They were out in front on the AI before anybody. Anyway, but I say all that to say, you know, that's a great success story. And I'm going somewhere with this, time back to the oil industry, but take Blockbuster, you know, the cautionary tale, right? I mean, they had the tiger by the tail. Netflix was an opportunity. They actually had an opportunity when they were at their peak to acquire Netflix. And they said, no, this whole, you know, DVD rental thing isn't really going to pan out. I mean, we can all sit and laugh right now. And I think there's one Blockbuster left. It's obviously not a corporate. It's a local brand. I want to say it's in Alaska. But anyway, I mean, Blockbuster was on every corner. When I was in my 20s and 30s, you couldn't go anywhere without finding a Blockbuster. And everyone remembers the late fees, which I think was part of what killed their brand. And why I would say, you could argue that the late fees were a spur in the saddle of technology advancing quicker. And that's because their late fee policy was ridiculous and they were a behemoth. But anyway, they're a dead company. They're a dead brand. And the reason why is because they couldn't look forward and innovate as a company. Now you come back to, those are company stories, but you come back to industry, which maybe the railroad is more relevant and its demise. Look at the oil industry. I mean, the discipline that the industry has been able to accomplish in the last, let's say 10 years, it's been going on longer, I think, but you look at, particularly in the last 10 years, maybe even the last 7 years, it's amazing. We as an industry have developed this discipline muscle in the midst of, and I think in large part to the ESG movement and the climate warriors. And, you know, every person on the planet believes that we should, you know, take care of our climate, but there's a lot of misinformation, particularly on the other side, and just propaganda and pandering. And to think we're going to not rely on petroleum products in any, like, certainly not in my lifetime, but even in the next 50 years, does that mean we don't develop? Sure, we need to develop. I mean, we need alternatives because we don't have enough even oil and gas to meet the demand that's required for energy of this exploding population. And so when I think about all that stuff, I think about just how, I don't know, how, what a great story it is to see how the industry has kept rig count, as an example, great, like mid-level. If you think about KPIs for the industry, it's a really good mid-level indicator of what used to be growth, but really isn't necessarily anymore, because rig count has been generally flat for years. Yet you've seen us explode in production. Why is that? Discipline, technology, those are great stories. And oil companies they're not going boom and bust like they used to, because they're more disciplined and they're not going to sit there and pander to governments and all the things that go on. They're actually going to listen to the business fundamentals of supply and demand. They're going to listen to the need to generate profit, not just grow needlessly. And so it's not the Wild West anymore. It's actually a brave new world, I think, for oil and gas, which is one of the reasons I'll tie back to your original question that I want to be in this business because I think there's no better time for us to be in this business when it's actually the industry by and large is trying really hard to act like a successful handful of businesses.
Which what's the business model that you guys are following? Are you trying to go out and obviously you're going to punch a whole bunch of ground holes in the ground. So you can essentially do it as a drill co. Are you going to guys go acquire any PDP? Are you going to raise private equity? Are you raising family office cash? Walk me through what's the vision and how are you guys planning on getting there?
Yeah, so I'll start with the underlying mission, which sort of it ties back to this a couple of things. One is my personal inspiration and what gets me up out of the bed every morning and what I love. So that's one thing. And then the second thing is really the tie into to what I think will. The opportunity within the industry as it sits right now. And so my personal, how I'm wired, I mean, is this try to keep this like bundled together. Right. I'm a unapologetic disciple of Jesus. So that's who I follow. Like if you're asking, you know, who's, you know, who would you want to meet if it's Jesus? So, that's where I draw my inspiration. I study scripture. I love it. I need Jesus because I'm a sinner. And if without him, I would fall short of God's perfect plan. And I need that grace because I am imperfect and I'm still learning, right? So even though I'm on the other side of what is salvation through grace by faith is important. It's important for me to continue to grow and learn in him. One of the ways to do that is, you know, I'm a provider, I'm a doer, I'm a worker. And so Petrovibe was in large part started because I have those needs to go do that in a context that honors him as a steward. So I view the world, anything that I have is his, anything anybody has is his, and I'm a steward. So I have a period of time in which I am required to manage this. And I didn't always think this way. Even when I what you call profess to be a born again believer when I was 13 years old. And there's been a faith journey in growing in that, in my faith in Christ. But there's a lot of figuring out in that. And when I really came down to it, this idea of stewardship was lost on me. And so I'm bringing up that word stewardship because it's really important that we understand that when we're pooling resources as an operator, fundraising, doing all the things that we're doing, bringing people together to do work, like David, he's our dozer operator in our project there in near Hallettsville. The guy is 70 years old. We're giving him an opportunity to work. We're stewarding this opportunity. We need to make sure that we do that the best way we can. Why is that exciting? Because I love just hearing about what's going on in David's life. You know, we pulled him off of the dozer. We were out there checking out our drill site. And I pulled him off the dozer and I said, come over here, let's talk, you know, tell me what's going on. And he's happy to tell his story. I mean, the guy's kind of alone in a dozer by himself. What he tells me, 80 hours a week on our project. So praise him for that. I mean, that's amazing. But it's good to see the impact that we can have on David and frankly, his interest. And he goes, I want to keep working until I'm 80. He goes, I'm not sure yet. I haven't figured that out. But he goes, I got lots left. I mean, this is a 70-year-old man running a bulldozer, 80 hours a week. And he's, you know what he was excited about?
We've got 80-year-old men running the country.
Well, we don't have enough time for that on this show, do we? Is that a thing? So, man, that's true. But there's no shuffling going around on that. He knows what he's doing when he gets into the dozer. But anyway, so, but what was great about him was he was just grateful that he got to work close to home. And I'm thinking to myself, man, this program, all of a sudden I had another gear on my mission. I was like, it's not just him. It's the other guys. I talked to the site supervisor. These guys are excited about being near home. That's great for their families. We need to do more to make sure we're going to see this project through. I really hadn't thought about that impact. Now, in my mind, visionary wise, I'm thinking, yeah, that's going to be the impact. This is great, right? It didn't really, I think, ring home until I talked to them and was on the site and really, these are like contract partners, right? I mean, they don't work directly for Petrovibe. They're on a project. Well, I want to make it so that they're doing all the work on our stuff so they can be home with their families and they can be part of their community and they can honestly just enjoy a good day's work nearby home. Cause that's a tough deal. I mean, you know, the oil business, people go where the work is and sometimes that's not next door. Sometimes that's states away, counties away at least. So, but anyway, having that impact, that's part of, that's at the real root. That is the stewardship that we get to have in our role. And I want to see that expand. I want to see that expand so that we can touch investors that way too. Like our partners that we get involved. I mean, you ask some questions about fundraising. Well, it all comes back to stewardship. And it's a very easy thing to throw out the word stewardship. What does it mean? Well, it means that you're stewarding someone else's resources. And if you look at how the character of the man that is required or to be qualified as a steward, Paul does a great job of that in his letter to Titus, where he talks about that when he's trying to help Titus understand how to build an elder board, if you will, for the church. Does that have application in business? Of course it does, because you're talking about the character of a man, and the character of a man needs to meet certain criteria for you to be able to be a steward and to be good at it. And I love one more story on stewardship. I love how Jesus talks about it. He talks in parables, right? Parables are, they're stories to help you understand the maybe the more complex things in a simple way. And so he does that a lot. And in Matthew 25, he actually talks about stewardship from the context of there's a master who gives talents. Talents are a form of money back in the day. And he is basically charged them. And there's multiple ways to understand the meaning of this, but the meaning is it's one meaning. But he gives these stewards, if you will, three of them. One he gives five talents. The other one he gives two, and one he gives one. And he goes away on a long journey, and he comes back. And the expectation that's set, which is more implied, not directly, is that's a little bit direct, but it's. He doesn't tell you the how, but he says the importance of the result is based on your effort to go and steward that and multiply it. And it's not for your own wealth building because it's not yours in the first place. You're just stewarding it. That gets missed a lot of times. A lot of people will read that story and they'll say, or that parable, and they'll go, oh, so I'm, you know, they'll impart it on themselves and go, this is about my wealth. It's not. You're actually building wealth for the kingdom. If you read it how Jesus meant it, it's not that at all. And so I love that because you're thinking about it in a way that the talents were the master's. You're to go and multiply those. Two of those guys did it great. They were rewarded for that. The other guy got cast into outer darkness. He buried it in the ground, which is actually even, it didn't say he went and frivolously wasted it. He put it in the ground and did nothing with it, which was actually worse. So that's sort of the core of stewardship. I love that because that feeds everything we do and it holds us accountable and it's hard. Like we make decisions every day where I'm like, what's the right stewardship? And you know, what's been awesome is to watch the team embrace that and how they do their jobs. Cause it's a mandate. Like that's how we, like it's a non-negotiable. It's I'm pretty flexible on a lot of stuff. I'm not flexible on that to the point where we're even having those conversations. What's the right stewardship answer to work with our partner on this when we run into a snag or, you know, something didn't work out in the timeline we wanted. So we need to call them and say, look, we're not ready for this, but we want to be, we appreciate you guys. Here's what's going on. Well, you got to give them the phone call in the right timing so they have time to prepare on their side to make adjustments. You can't wait till the last day in hopes of, you know, God's going to bring it through. Well, it doesn't look like that's the conservative stewardship play. So let's be conservative. And then if we come in before then, great, but at least we gave our partners a chance to make an adjustment for their business. And that's already happened a few times because, man, this capital raising's tough.
So what's the business model?
I never got to that. So the business model, so yeah, I know you asked that and I went left and then right. So it's the business model is, it's straight up scale. So the idea behind it is we want to take our first project, which is 50 wells. We have $20 million in science on this particular project already in the bag.
Where are you drilling these at?
This is north of Hallettsville it's about an hour and a half west of here. So if you take 10 on your way to San Antonio, it's Lavaca County.
Okay.
So So we're in Lavaca County. We have
vertical wells, horizontal wells.
Yeah, vertical wells. Okay. Our first phase is 50 wells. Okay. Simple drilling. They are naturally pressured, so heavy liquids content, which we like for obvious reasons. You get premium pricing. Simple drilling. It's an opportunity for, again, a stewardship idea there. You keep costs low. You keep your maintenance failure probability low, because it's not, you know, look, we're a small company. So us going and drilling big horizontals and having, you got to have capital at levels we don't have or really don't need to be trying to access at this level. You need to keep things simple. And they're mid depth. I mean, you're talking, you know, not south of 10,000 feet. So, but anyway, the idea is we've got a scalable view on the science so we can turn that into economic value. And that is, it's really to bring scale to this project deliver a 3x return to our investors in a 5-year period without an exit. We obviously, it is part of the strategy to seek an exit, but not necessarily one to execute on one unless it makes sense for the partnership. So again, all that stuff we talked about before, it's an opportunity to create jobs. It's an opportunity to drive value for that local community that has been largely ignored by the bigs, but the bigs aren't the ones who produce anyway. I mean, they're 10 to 12% of the market. I don't know if a lot of people know this, but independent companies, small and medium-sized independent companies, make up between 87 and 90% of all the production in the largest producing country in the mm-hmm. in the world. So, but anyway, the business plan I would say the most important thing about how we do that is the reinvestment. So very conservative underwriting. You know, we've got data that's, let's say, worth one. We've risked our pro forma down to 60% of that. And our geologist has a 75% success rate at picking profitable locations. So that spells value for investors. It spells value for us, and it allows us to actually feed all of this mission we're talking about. And so, and it's scalable. There's a whole lot there that we're still interpreting from the 3D seismic that we have. And again, you talked about, are we doing PDP? This is all development. We do have interest in acquisitions as we get in a position to do that, but that there's a lot of variables that go into that, as you know, and to be able to do that is, it's part of our longer term strategy. Right now we need to, stay focused on getting this first wave out and proven. And, again, we're in a proven area. We're not wildcatting. We're not, I wouldn't even call this exploring. It's really not. I mean, we have mm-hmm. proven trap types. We have thousands of, well control to look at. Well logs. We have proprietary data that nobody in the area has. It's believable, actually, because I've seen it. The data is amazing. So I don't know, that was still a lot of words for what's the business model, but it's basically all about scale.
Something tells me you don't ever have a few words.
I know. Well, you did say in the beginning, the more you talk, the better it is for the show. So I was kind of like,
well, I regret saying that.
Am I leaning into that too much?
I'm going to pull that back a little bit.
Okay, my bad. Fair enough. I deserve that.
Why not just go buy PDP in the beginning? Why do it the hard way right out the gate?
I don't know. Some days I ask myself that very question. I think it, PDP is always nice, but it's kind of boring. It's got a low risk profile. I think to change the narrative and to do something unique like we are doing with this idea of stewardship and putting that out there, you need to be able to do that from a, you need to make a bigger splash. And it doesn't mean you couldn't do that from PDP. I mean, I'm sitting here asking myself that question, why not do that? I think what happens is, to be really candid, you get old school influence in the industry, which isn't bad, by the way. I'm not saying there's not. I just raved about all the discipline in the industry. That's not a bad thing to a point. But to innovate, it's difficult to have that kind of old school influence and constantly be trying to get somebody. I mean, I actually considered it. I mean, I've had conversations talking about, hey, start in the PDP and you can build off of that. That's always the story. It's, you know, so it sounds like a little bit of a contradiction. Maybe it is, but that's why I don't want to be slowed down in the mission by old school thinking. And since I don't have $100 million laying around, I'm not the one who's going to be making that decision. I'm going to be influencing that decision, which I have a little bit more leverage in that influence in this model than I do that. That's why. Mm. That sounds like control is probably what the answer is. That's fair. So
you punch these first 50 holes in the ground. What's the North Star like five years from now, 10 years from now? You said exit if it makes sense, but assuming you don't, like, what is this? Like, what, do you keep punching holes in the ground? Do you have a,
yeah,
you have a vision of what this becomes, stewardship aside?
Yeah. So, you know, just on a practical level, there's, in 5 years, I hope we're a lot closer to the, right now the vision is 50 wells, okay, in this project, but the scale has scalability in it. Excuse me. And when you think about that, there's layers to this. I mean, honestly, next year we should be on project two. So we're in Petrovibe one right now. That's this project. There should be Petrovibe two, should be starting in 2025. That's really it. And it would look similar to this. Now, where you're starting to have some variances is we have other formations that we're still analyzing in addition to more analysis and what we learn inside this formation. So as you think through what that looks like, the opportunity is substantial, but you know, this is a capital intensive business. So my 5-year vision is we're, you know, north of 100 wells. If we can make the analogous acquisition magic happen, you know, $300-400 million company, in revenue. And, that's a huge number, but you don't get anywhere by thinking small. So, and not operating small, and the scalability is there. The field can deliver it. And it's funny because the bigs, they're not looking at what we're looking at, and the smalls, they don't know how to scale. So there's this vacuum that we're just stepping right into, and we think we've got what it takes to make it happen. So
how's the fundraising experience been? Walk us through that.
It's been humbling. That's in a word. We've actually done pretty well, all things considered so far. The challenge has been just, you know, part of the stewardship idea is this particular project, and this is really important. So the how matters. In order to create critical mass to overcome the challenge of the decline curve, which every operator faces, is you've got to create critical mass in your production, and you've got to be able to be willing to reinvest. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because fewer people are long-term minded than you might think. You know, you've got your old school investors who've done it a certain way, you know, working interest. We don't do that. We actually have a partnership model where they participate in all the assets and all the asset value build. And so—
So they come in as equity and not as working interest?
Yeah, they come in as equity, not as working interest, right. Okay. And which working interest has so many limitations and so it's so much higher risk. Like as a business guy coming in from the outside, I don't understand. I guess that's the way they've always done it, but that doesn't mean you should. And if you look at how the bigs do it and the companies that have actually scaled, they've done that through reinvestment of capital. And you can only do that if you've got the right equity base. So like you do it with debt too, but that's kind of the issue is that we're just, that's been the challenge that we've faced in the fundraising portion is finding truly long-term minded people. And because you're not going to get a distribution for 18 months, you're going to get a great, obviously the IDC tax breaks are fantastic, but you got to live on that in year one and year two, you know, midway Q3, you're going to start seeing distribution scale up as we begin to scale down the reinvestment, but it is, you know, both barrels all reinvestment. So you can create that critical mass to get above your capital threshold, which is so important. And frankly, honestly, no one's doing this at our level. No one is. And you know why? Because it's hard. It's hard to raise money. It's hard to get people to buy into the belief, but we are committed to it because it's the right kind of stewardship. And it's the only way you're going to get the numbers. You could talk about monthly income that's going to be at a certain level and all these things you're going to do to work over wells later to try to keep it at the certain level. You're never going to get to a true strong multiple inside a five-year window if you don't reinvest first. And have some patience. Wait. Have some discipline. Wait until you have critical mass because you've been reinvesting. And that's really that's the difference in PetroVibe One that most people just aren't willing to do because it's hard.
Operating in general is hard. Punching holes in the ground is hard.
Yeah. It's so dark down there. So dark. So dark.
Peter, this has been awesome. Best of luck to you guys and everything. We'll check in here in a year, see how you guys are doing.
Awesome.
We'll make something happen.
Thanks for having me, man. Absolutely. Appreciate it. It was awesome.
All right, guys, take 2 seconds, leave a rating, review, share with your friends. We'll catch you in the next one.